This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
You know, I started playing with Animal Collective. Then it just happened to be a synth that we had around. So we started just going into it internally, into the circuitry, and just completely bending organ sounds and just like, you know.
Wow, you're brave.
I thought only Brian Eno was allowed to do that.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
Here we are. We're live. I'm in Berlin. Lowell is in Los Angeles. And I'd like to welcome David Portner. Hailing, I think you're in North Carolina, right?
Yes, Asheville, outside of Asheville, North Carolina.
Well, welcome, and you are the founder of Animal Collective, right?
One of them. You know, we've kind of all been around. We're all in there, four of us. Yeah.
You know, I have to tell you that you are responsible for me becoming
a father.
Well, I'm gonna get a daughter-in-law in a few weeks.
That's quite a responsibility.
Yes, very, a lot of responsibility to put on your shoulders, but. My son and my future daughter-in-law just told me that on their first date about 8 years ago, and he put on the album Sung Tongs, and he's thought, this is the litmus test. If she likes this, we've probably got, you know, we've got some kind of thing going, you know?
That's a tough test there.
Yeah, and as it turned out, they're getting married in a couple of weeks, and they're going to play some of your music at the wedding. And
oh, wow.
So, you know, you're responsible for that. So that's what I wanted. I want to say thank you. You know?
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be of service. Hope it works out.
Oh, I'm sure it will. They've been together 8 years. It's going to work out.
It's all downhill from here now. You see, we can't really beat that. How do we top that one?
I asked him as well, my son. So describe the music to me, you know, because I've listened, and I know what I think about it, but I said, I want to know what he got from it, because he was really very, very, very big fan. And he said, it's like the Beach Boys with meets Music Concrete, meets Can, played on cheap digital samplers. So is that fair, or is that, you know?
That's a fair description, I would say. Yeah. You can't really hate on being compared to Can, the great Can. Love them since high school.
Well, that's good, because that's a connection that all three of us will have, because, you know, for me personally, Jackie Leibitz was, you know, a great influence, you know, with his...
Amazing, yeah.
Play... monotonous, you know. Jackie always said play monotonous, and I took him at his word and just, you know, played it round and round and round and round and round and round, and then played it some more around, you know.
How did you come into, what was going on, like, where you were growing up? How did krautrock find its way in there?
I think just probably from reading magazines, you know, music magazines and interviews with bands I was into at the time, like that were playing, you know, kind of like 90s indie rock, Pavement, rock band Sonic Youth. They talked about those bands a lot, you know, Can and Noi. And it was tough to find the records around Baltimore. I grew up in outside of Baltimore City, but Baltimore area. But that's where my music stores were to go to get records. And it was just sort of like then, like, you know, you had to be kind of lucky to find a Can record or a Noi record. But then, like, right as I was ending high school, kind of like the last couple of years, all the, you know, kind of like the reissue boom kind of happened, where everything just started getting reissued on CDs, you know, and like all this great German psychedelic music just started.
I was living in France, I think, at that point, and I would go to Fnac in Toulouse, FNAC. But it's like I'd always go to the same little section nobody else went to. You know, there was like the new French chart-topping hit, and then the something from overseas that was the chart-topping secondary. And then there's a corner over there, you know, and every time I'd go back, there'd be fewer and fewer. Who am I thinking of? The guys who were in Cluster. We're talking Eno and
Mobius.
Mobius, yeah, I was going to say Mobius.
Redelius, Mobius, you got it. Yeah. I just fell in love with their names as much as anything. And then the fact that he did everything on one little synth.
To ask you guys that if that kind of more of the electronic sounds influenced your bands at that time, that, you know, because there was, I feel like both your bands, I'm talking Susie and the Banshees and The Cure now, seem to shift, you know, kind of from more of a rocky kind of what I would consider like post-punky sound in the late 70s to, like, you know, throwing in some more, you know, maybe not full on electronics, but, you know, like gravitating that sound.
I think we found out, certainly in the Banshees camp, if you think of some of the, you know, the albums we just mentioned, and say, like, I mean, Severin came on the tour bus, which was a little bus, with a little bag of cassettes, a box of cassettes. And there's one called Can Opener, and I've never, ever seen it since. It's never listed, it's not been re-released, and it was a cassette, and it had Moonshake and Vitamin C, and, you know, and he also, what else did he, and we had, like, because Kraftwerk kind of came out at the time, you know, there was Radioactivity, I think, Trans-Europe Express was a huge, I suppose it felt like a huge hit, but it was still really small.
Right, yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, and the only way I heard this stuff in the small town in Northwest England was because I had a friend who was like maybe 2 years older. So he'd left school and was working in the local glass factory. So he came home on a Friday with a huge wage packet. And on Saturday morning, we'd sort of like go and buy some of those really weird albums you keep coming back with. And he'd come back with Faust and Amandule.
Yeah, I love it all.
Tangerine Dream
was kind of getting a bit kind of guitar-y. But I remember the Faust album, the one that was like clear vinyl and a clear sleeve with a sort of x-ray of a hand, and we had no idea what this stuff would sound like. We purely on what they looked like, it was
right, totally.
And Alex would come in and I'd say, oh, we've got a new one. Because he had money, because they were expensive. They were like,
well, because they were imports, right? So
yeah. It was just, that was the opening. That was it wasn't as if we went off and then tried to copy that, because we didn't start a band, we're too young. But we did kind of then listen for synthesizers. So I did anyway, in everything.
Yeah,
and it didn't matter what it was in. If it had a synth in it that sounded a bit, then I'd just want to go and buy it, find it, you know.
Yeah, there was always, I think, for The Cure, there was always interest in things that were a little more esoteric. And if you have to remember back, you know, even bands like Hawkwind had, like, you know, rudimentary synths and and stuff going on.
That was the Harlequin noise I just did. It was
You did. That's what it reminded me of. Yeah. That was Dick Mick. Dick Mick had his, like a white noise generator. That's all he played on stage. But so it went from there. And it went on.
On and on.
In the early 80s, you have to remember, though, there was a great revolution with things like drum machines, which hadn't really been around in a great way before then. And we became fascinated with that. And it was part of my job. One of the reasons I changed from playing drums to playing keyboards and stuff was I wanted to pull that into the band. And I wanted to drag the rest of them in because they were fairly Luddite. You know, I would say to them, if you can't hit it, or spank it, you don't want to use it, do you? You know, and they'd sort of wander around with their clubs, you know.
Oh, perish the thought.
Yeah, beating things. Like I bought the first Apple Mac computer that they had in this one place. I remember it's called Sterling Sound in London. They only had two of them, and I bought one. And I think John Paul Jones bought the other, right? So
yeah. You guys were earning money at
a
that.
A bit. We were earning a few bobs.
Severin was always round your place, down to.
What year was that?
Oh, whenever it first came out, 84, something like that, maybe, the Mac. And, you know, I spent a year trying to figure out how it worked and then sort of took it back in pieces a year later and said, fix it for me, please. And, but, you know, that general knowledge of those things, of what we could do with stuff, was really the reason for doing it. And then at that point, you know, fate intervened because we'd finished doing Pornography, which was like, Pornography is a bit earlier, but when we finished doing Pornography, we went on tour, and on Pornography, we had the first drum machine we ever put on a record. So we put Dr. Rhythm, or whatever it was called, and we put that on the first track. And when we went on tour, we thought, well, we can't take the drum machine with us. It's going to be too complicated to do that. So we recorded it onto a reel-to-reel, and we played the reel-to-reel live for some reason. I never remember quite why.
Dangerous business, it seems like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
very dangerous business, yeah. And so after that, you know, we went on the big tour, and then the band split up, and there was only two of us. It was just me and Robert, and we said, well, what are we going to do? And I said, well, why don't I just concentrate all on the electronic stuff and bring that in? Because, you know, we can have the drums play by themselves, and we can have, you know, stuff sequenced and make, you know, tracks. And so we did some records like that.
Because that's how the Banshees really, when I joined them, they were just two. So Susie and Severin had been in, like, Chapels in London, the publisher, but they'd been in their little demo room. And everything was with like a Roland Compu rhythm. Something like that, anyway. And they all had that little whistle. It went like a hi-hat samba, not quite. like a cha-cha with a samba or something, or a rumba, you know. So they'd just mix up these presets. So when I came in, there were a lot of like tracks, and Red Light was on Kaleidoscope, and that's just a precursor really to, you know, there was a lot of that sound around with early Depeche and Yazoo and, you know, Soft Cell, who we hooked up with Mark Holman pretty quick. As soon as he arrived in London, we abducted him.
Echo and the Bunnymen did drum machine stuff back then too, right?
Yeah, well, there was Echo and the Bunnymen up in Eric's, across on the other stage from across the other side of the Mersey were Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. They may not have had a reel-to-reel, but I think Echo and the Bunnymen did. I think that was Echo. When I left Liverpool, I gave Les Pattinson, I think, when I left Liverpool, gave him a cymbal. I said, when you get a drummer, give him this. It was a crap cymbal. But that was a kind of strange thing. There were some, if you like, bands that kind of kept to that, if you like, vision of the new future. And then there were, I don't know how it is, we sort of tried to incorporate a different aspect. I don't know what it was. Maybe it's our roots in bands or the need. You know, it's a strange thing. I always wondered why we didn't keep it simple as a 2-3-piece thing.
Me and Budgie started when the punk revolution happened, and it really was very important to starting the band. So that attitude was still going on when we came to put more of the electronic stuff in. We wanted to use them, but we wanted to use it in a way that was different and maybe less precious. You know, it wasn't until a bit later when everybody brought a Synclavier and, you know, all these highly expensive electronics to make things. I wasn't interested in making things sound like the original instrument. I didn't want to play a cello so it sounded exactly like a cello. And you could, why wouldn't I just ask a cello player to come and do it? I wanted to make sounds that were different and unique in their own way. And that's really what I enjoy. It's still what I enjoy, making things that sound, you know, a lot different. But there's a lot more support for it nowadays. You know? How about yourself? How did you come to like use, you know, old digital samplers, cheap digital samplers? What was it inherent in that for you that you liked?
Well, I think at first it was just sort of like whatever I could get or whatever I had around, you know what I mean, to make sound. I mean, a lot of, yeah, making crazy or more different kind of sounds was more about like not having a lot to use maybe and needing to, you know, improvise in a certain sense. Like if you didn't have a snare, maybe you'd use like a box or a plate or something like that. And I think like maybe we started, you know, playing together as a band that way, you know, just kind of improvising and using different things. If we didn't have a lot of stuff around, that's how we got into just like, you know, into being like, oh, let's use that instead for a sound. Or we started getting interested in, yeah, taking regular instruments. Like one of the first synth I ever had was a DX27. I think my a friend of my brother's was getting rid of it, and so I just took it on, and that's sort of, I played piano growing up, and I kind of wanted to just mess around with it. And so I just had it then to play, you know, just to play synth lines and stuff on it. But when, you know, I started playing with Animal Collective, then it just happened to be a synth that we had around. So we started just going into it internally, into the circuitry, and just completely bending organ sounds and just like, you know.
Wow, you're brave.
I thought only Brian Eno was allowed to do that.
Well, I was going to say, you know, when you said, oh, like, you know, the DX, you know, 20, I was thinking of like the DX7, which was the most impossibly difficult synth to program because it was always on that tiny little screen with these really abstract codes to program it. And there was a period there at the beginning of like the 80s where you'd listen to records and pick out the patch that they'd used on the DX7, like, you know, was it the Shakuhachi or the Kyoto or Koto or whatever, because nobody could actually change them at all. So they all sounded the same. So it was easy to pick out, you know, what patch somebody had used on the record. But you're talking about going in and circuit bending stuff. I mean, I know people that do it now, but it's still out of my whole league, my imagination. I'm going to get inside with the circuitry and change things. What made you do that?
Just to get different sounds. We appreciated like a broken kind of sound, if to put it the best way I can, you know? And yeah, it just seemed a little bit more like, to us, that was kind of like the future of music, kind of like starting and coming up. You know, we're talking about Can and, you know, yeah, what you guys, your guys' bands and those, that era bands. If we're talking about gear though, I wanted to, I just thought, you know, maybe, yeah, it'd be cool for me to bring up the Flanger, because
yeah,
I feel like,
yeah.
You both made records that have Flanger that has really, you know, inspired me in terms of sounds on a record and stuff like that. I don't know.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think for me, I think about that. And I remember when, you know, we started getting the Flanger, but it was always like, one of the first albums I ever had was Axis Boulder's Love, you know, Hendrix. And there's a brilliant bit at the end of that where Mitch Mitchell's playing the drums and they just use tape flanging. And it when I was like 13 listening to that, it was like the orgasmic moment in the whole record where he does his big fill and suddenly it just flanges into nowhere, and I loved it. So I guess, you know, me and Robert always liked Hendrix, so I guess that's part of the reason it started, you know. Plus, you know, for the first time you didn't have to have very expensive machinery. You could use those little pedals. In fact, I'm sure that Robert still uses half of them, you know, but he probably owns the factory now. But the other thing, when you're talking about keyboards, for a long time, a very signature sound of The Cure was the Selina string machine, which was just, you know, so I think it's Italian and it only makes one sound. You know, it doesn't, it's like this big box that, that makes maybe some string sounds and a little brass sound. And but we use that on everything, you know, on everything. It was
that's
great.
That's very, very Italian. It's just one sound, but it's beautiful.
Yes, beautiful. One beautiful sound. And I tried later on, I had like all this expensive software from Emulator, because I was talking to them before they bought out, you know, like the E3 or something, and they would send me like different models and stuff. And I had the software that I was trying to capture, I was trying to resample the Selina so that I could use it on stage with a sampler and not have to take this big box with me everywhere. I could never get quite the artifacts were in that sound. I could never quite capture them all and make it sound, you know, convincing. So we still had to take that big box everywhere with us.
Who made the Selina? Do you remember?
ARP. I mean, I may have lost my mind completely thinking it's Italian, but I think it's Italian for some reason. Ah, I found the Selina page. I was completely wrong. It wasn't Italian. It was Dutch.
I want it to be Italian. The Italians probably made one, then they sold the idea to the Dutch.
Yeah. And it had six tones. Violin, viola, trumpet, horn, cello, and contrabass. And that was it. In this big box. And I think I actually might even have a sample.
God, name that song.
It's the sound of Just Like Heaven, I think.
Run into gear like that breaking a lot on tour, having equipment problems?
You know, we used to have at one point, we used to have a load of Ensoniq Mirages, which were very plasticky, cheap samplers, right? And, you know, the keyboard was probably, you know, it looked like it was like made from the top of milk bottles or something. And I would regularly spill vast amounts of beer inside the keyboard while we were playing live. And my tech would have to turn it upside down and dry it out with the hairdryer and things. And the hard drive would be falling out the side because I dropped it on the ground. And that thing went on forever and ever. I loved that. So, yeah, we had things that were breaking. I think that all changed later on where it got a bit more specific, I think. Oh, yeah. So, David, the other thing that I had that did used to get broken a lot was the Synair snare, like synth drum, because the first ones were just like a metal box with a speaker screwed to the bottom of the surface that you hit. So, you know, it would work the reverse way around. So you hit the top, the speaker would vibrate, and then it would go into this little module that produced some kind of white noise. But of course, you know, after about 2 weeks or probably about 2 days with my compatriot here, if you're hitting them, they just disintegrated because, you know, they weren't meant to, you know, be hit that hard. Yeah, you know?
Which ones were they? Were that the yellow things?
No, black with lots of knobs around the side and a little piece of rubber on the top.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Shall I find the Synair here? I've probably got a sample of that too.
So, Animal Collective, you are also, you do individual projects, or certainly you do now. Was it always that way?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of started as individual projects of sorts, just sort of like four friends. Yeah, just kind of trading musical ideas and playing with each other, kind of play music, you know, like in certain, two of us would play together, like pretty much how we do it now, you know, just kind of like a pastime, you know. And when we were in school, you know, like, when we started, so, and also in different places early on, so made it hard for us all to play together all the time. So yeah, we kind of just came into writing our own music individually, and then, you know, would take the time to come together and tried, you know, making it like a full force thing in New York kind of early on, just, you know, but just with jobs and you know, all the other stuff going on, it just we found it easier to just kind of make it more relaxed and just kind of, yeah, whoever wants to be there.
I was going to say, is that the, do you think that's a kind of a secret to the longevity of it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, my one bandmate and I, we worked together at the record store, then we would go to practice and we lived together, and it was just too much time around each other after a while. So yeah, it just seemed to work better for us if there was more, a little bit more distance, you know.
I wanted to ask you a question. So we talked to Mac, who lives out in there from Superchunk. He lives out in North Carolina. He told us the main reason he lives there was because you could have a quality of life that was reasonable, and you could get a place to play for your band as well. You could have a place to rehearse. You could have a place to put a studio. It wasn't like he started off going into New York, and of course it was way too expensive to exist there as a band doing things. So I think it's getting harder and harder, because like when me and Budgie were little boys, well, not little boys, but we were teenagers and stuff, but we started touring around, and especially like in America. In the early 80s, you know, The Cure could make it work, like in a tour bus, and play four or five shows a week. And if we played some colleges who usually had some money to pay you, you could actually have a life. You could actually do it as your full, you know, that would be your whole profession to do. I don't know if that's that possible anymore, you know, because it's just so expensive to get around, and there's no income from records anymore and stuff, you know. What do you think?
Yeah, and then it's a lot more competitive now too. I mean, not that the competition is real, but I mean, there's just so many bands.
Yeah.
Not that there weren't a lot of bands, you know, back when y'all were touring like that, like, but I mean, there's a lot of competition to get dates at venues, and so yeah, there's a lot more complicating everything, I guess, and you can't just.
The best thing I liked in that was your phrase, like, not that the competition's real. That's the best attitude ever. That's great. Yeah. That's what we always thought. Hey, there's plenty of competition, but it's not real. You know, we're just gonna. So, I mean, do you think that's due to the fact that everybody can hear everything all the time because of the internet, or what is it?
Yeah, I think so. I think also, like I was saying before, when I started getting into a lot of obscure stuff, or, you know, stuff that at one time was maybe harder to find, it was just because, yeah, suddenly things just started becoming a lot more available, and that was, you know, there was everything getting reissued for a while, and then, yeah, the internet and just being able to upload stuff onto the web and all that, get free music. And I mean, it, as much as it's hurt the music industry, it also helped a lot in the way of just spreading music around and influencing, you know, music that's happening. So it's interesting for sure.
I don't know how do you feel about it completely, because I have like this love-hate thing about the internet. On one hand, I think it's like wonderful that it's, you know, managed to get, you know, information worldwide, and on the other hand, I think it's like, you know, out of the devil's bosom, because it is going to destroy us all, you know.
Devil's loins.
Devil's loins. I wasn't going to say that, but you've said it for me.
I had to.
I mean, I think it's a lot too much. It's just too much, you know, and it's a lot of, I think you can limit yourself, you know, to how much of it you access, and I think that's maybe the key of finding the balance of, you know, I feel like I kind of grew up half-half, you know, like just before the boom was, you know, the internet boom. So I spent a lot of my early life, you know, not, you know, I don't relate to it in that way. We went on tours, and it was, yeah, it was just sort of like still putting up flyers. Like, you know, when we would play around New York, I'd put up flyers around all the music stores in New York and that kind of thing. And that's how we came to be. And that, I mean, that's how I got into visual art.
You're a real musician. No, it's true though. You know, people say, well, you know, I put it on my Instagram and did it on Facebook. I'm like, what? We had to go into college town to go into the local record store and hand out flyers, tell them that we're playing tonight at the university or whatever, and that, you know, come back, little boy, when you've done real work. You know, that's what I think. Yeah. No, I mean, it's it's just hard whatever way you look at it, I think. But
so what is about North Carolina? Do you have was it a sympathetic governor or something?
Of sorts. I mean, for me, I mean, Asheville in particular, the city is a bit of an oasis. You know, I feel like just in terms of its liberal atmosphere, that kind of thing. You know, I mean, for me, I lived in LA just before living here, and then New York for 13 years before that. And I just kind of got over living in a large city, you know, and just wanted to get back to the woods. And I kind of grew up closer to woods, and, you know, I don't know, and the quality of life, like Max said, is definitely better. I think even in places like Asheville now, especially post 2020, it's tough. You know what I mean? You can't even it's hard to even get a practice space around here, you know, and be able to afford it. Plus have a house and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's kind of getting hard everywhere.
Just before the pandemic shut everything down, I went on tour with my first book. Then I kind of did it like the first Cure tours. I sort of went to all the small towns and small places, and just, you know, anywhere that had a record store or a bookstore, I would go and do an event for my book. And one of the places I went, I was talking to a guy. Actually, he's the manager of the Flaming Lips, and he has a class out there at college out in Oklahoma City. So I went there, and the Flaming Lips, you know, Oklahoma City is not really that expensive, right, to live. So they have a whole city block. They have a whole city block as their rehearsal space and things. And I went down there to see them and see Wayne and things. And it's ridiculous. It's like, you know, if you had to buy that, if you had to even rent it in Los Angeles, I mean, I don't think you could buy it. I think it would be, you know, anybody's reason to be able to buy a city block. But if you had to rent it, it would be, you know, it'd be millions, you know, just for a couple of weeks or something. I exaggerate, but you get my meaning. It's like, you know, I suppose, you know, in these little outposts, and I'm not saying Asheville's a little outpost because I know it's not, but
yeah,
you know, it's
small. I mean, it is small.
Yeah, Oklahoma City definitely had its day as a little outpost, because I arrived there at 7 o'clock in the evening on the plane and walked in this huge airport, and there was nobody about. Everybody that worked there had gone home. He said if there's no flights, you know, going out, everybody just goes home, you know? So there's nobody in the airport at all.
See, if you'd gone there in 1800, you know, Asheville, you'd 38 people. There'd have been you and 38 others. That'd have been like no queue at the airport whatsoever. No plane.
No line to get on anything. Yeah. Yeah, you know, they have a quite a burgeoning art scene there, though, which is, you know, heartening. There are places, you know. That's what I like about America. You can go into the middle of nowhere, be driving for 10 hours, and then suddenly you come across an oasis, you know. And I imagine Asheville is a bit like that. So.
Yeah, or definitely was at one time. I think it's definitely grown a lot, but they're popping up all over the place in the U.S. for sure.
Yeah, which is good. You know, I like that. I like the idea of that. That makes me feel hopeful. You know, my niece goes to school out in Iowa, you know, and I went to visit her a couple of years ago. We were there, and was it last year? And in the middle of the afternoon, we're in the center of town, you know, and it's like any college town that I'd ever been to. You know, it has the same restaurants and coffee shop and all this stuff and that. And I started to feel really weird. You know, I was like, it's the middle of the afternoon. Why do I feel really weird? And it's like, because it was deja vu. Like every gig that I'd ever played in the college towns, you know, that was the time that I would be in town in the middle of the afternoon, getting ready, you know, before sound check, go around and to the local record store and give them some flyers and stuff and say, hey, we're playing tonight, and come and see us. So it was really, it was a very strange time travel experience for me, you know.
This is bizarre, I think. Robert Moog?
Yeah, the Mr. Moog, the man.
Born in Asheville.
Yeah, the Moog factory is here. The Moog factory
still there. Okay, now I feel a pilgrimage coming.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
we could do a pilgrimage there, and then we'll take the other one up to the other place for Mr. Buchler, on the West Coast, right? You know, he was. I'm going to ask you that question then.
Oh, look out! Watch out! The finger's pointing.
Moog or Buchla? You know, yes or no? You know, Moog or Buchla?
Oh, I like both. I like both.
You like both? Okay. So which is goth?
Which is goth? I would say. Well, I mean, you tell me. I don't know. Do y'all use Moogs? Have you used some Moog? Like, I would say Moog, maybe.
Oh, okay. I'd say the Buchla's goth.
Oh, you'd say Buchla's goth. I don't know.
It seems a little more specialized in the Buchla.
The Buchla, yeah, the Buchla.
I only came across it recently. My friend was like kind of collecting them, and he had one live on the road, and it was full of like, you know, bits of solder that were too bulky, and you know.
It's got stuff to plug in. What I liked about it was when they first made it, it didn't have any manual or any signs what things were on the faceplates. It was like this alchemist's sort of dream. You had to sort of just plug things in and hope that something worked. And that to me is fascinating, you know. And Susan Cesani, who we love, who wrote the quote that we use all the time, that's what she used. She was like the first person to kind of sort of have one play it for a long time, you know. So.
Yeah, I have a music easel. It's pretty cool to play, but yeah, it's tough. It's difficult and hard to take. I took it on one record tour, but I don't think I would want to tour with it so much. That stuff's very precarious.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Butchie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2023.